It goes through into Leviticus, which just keeps going on. So page 67. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting before the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out, until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. Then Leviticus. The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. He said, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when anyone among you brings an offering to the Lord, bring as your offering an animal from either the herd or the flock. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you are to offer a male without defect. You must present it at the entrance to the tent of meeting so that it will be acceptable to the Lord. You are to lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you. You are to slaughter the young bull before the Lord, and then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and splash it against the sides of the altar at the entrance to the tent of meeting. You are to skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aaron, the priest, are to put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, including the head and the fat, on the wood that is burning on the altar. You are to wash the internal organs and the legs with water, and the priest is to burn all of it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. If the offering is a burnt offering from the flock, from either the sheep or the goats, you are to offer a male without defect. You are to slaughter it at the north side of the altar before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall splash its blood against the sides of the altar. You are to cut it into pieces, and the priest shall arrange them, including the head and the fat, on the wood that is burning on the altar. You are to wash the internal organs and the legs with water, and the priest is to bring all of them and burn them on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. If the offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, you are to offer a dove or a young pigeon. The priest shall bring it to the altar, wring off the head, and burn it on the altar. Its blood shall be drained out on the side of the altar. He is to remove the crop and the feathers and throw them down the east of the altar where the ashes are. He shall tear it open by the wings, not dividing it completely, and then the priest shall burn it on the wood that is burning on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, an aroma pleasing to the Lord.
How are you feeling about studying Leviticus? There's probably a few different reactions, aren't there? There's probably a few people who are kind of nervously but anticipating it. Like, you know, this is a strange part of the Bible. I'd like to know more about it. After that reading, there might be a few of you that are just a bit grossed out. Like, there's a lot of blood and guts and a lot of animals dying. Maybe a few of you have had this experience. At the start of a new year, you decide to make a resolution that you're going to read through the whole Bible this year. And in the book of Genesis, it seems to be going really well. Exodus has got some great stories. You get to the book of Leviticus, and suddenly that resolution starts to really feel pretty weighty. And you get into a couple of chapters of Leviticus, and it starts to get harder and harder. And then the wheels fall off, and you fail. And you wait till next year to make another resolution. It's not an easy book. But I have to say, having studied it in some detail in the last few weeks as I've prepared for this series, I've been struck again by what a special book it is. And I'm going to show you some of that as we move into the series. But I'm going to begin by praying that God would show it to us. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, this is your word, and we don't want to be people who pick and choose what we hear from you. We want to listen to everything you have to say to us. So speak to us now from this book of Leviticus, as you spoke out of the tent of meeting to your people in the wilderness at Sinai centuries ago. Speak to us now so that we might know how to come before you in true worship. We ask this for the sake of your Son who draws us. Amen. First thing to know about the book of Leviticus is that it's a million details shaped by an invitation. And the invitation is this: come closer. And so is your life. A million details shaped by an invitation: come closer. And once you start to realise that the book of Leviticus and your life have those two things in common, the book of Leviticus becomes a very exciting read. Let me show you. The first thing that jumps out at the book of Leviticus is the endless amounts of detail. Rules about animal sacrifices, what you can eat, what you can touch, what you can do with your buildings, who you can sleep with, how to grow your crops, how to treat immigrants. Leviticus doesn't have many famous verses, but here are some of the best known. The first one is one that's notorious. Leviticus 18, verse 22. Do not have sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman. That is detestable. The book of Leviticus, The book of Leviticus presumes to be able to tell you who you can sleep with. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 32. Stand up in the presence of the aged. There's a lot of you disobeying that command right now. Show respect for the elderly and revere your God. I am the Lord. That seems like quite an interesting detail. The book of Leviticus presumes to tell you whether you should sit or stand in the presence of those who are older than you. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. Love your neighbour as yourself. Very famously quoted by Jesus. That's the second of all the great commands. The same book that tells you, presumes to tell you who you can sleep with and whether you should sit or stand, also contains within it the greatest summary of how you're to relate to the people around you. How do you make sense of all those rules and details? Do you pick and choose? Do you write the whole thing off as a bizarre part of human religious history? Do you engage in shellfish ethics? People reason like this. Leviticus prohibits eating shellfish, prawns. But you all do that, don't you? Well, most of us do. You like a good prawn on the barbie, if you're an Australian. So clearly, you don't think that the book of Leviticus is very relevant. It prohibits eating shellfish. I eat shellfish. This is a book that doesn't really relate to me. I'm going to suggest that that's not really the right way to think about it. Here's a principle for reading Leviticus. Leviticus communicates truth about God through detailed descriptions of actions and through patterns and contrasts between different kinds of actions. But behind all the detail stands a powerful and coherent vision of the world and of us and of our relationship with God. Leviticus, the old Jewish rabbis used to say, embraces the whole world. It's a million details, but it's shaped by an invitation. And this morning we're going to look at that in the first seven chapters of the book. It's a thematic section about offering sacrifices. And obviously I'm going to skim over the details to try and show you what's there without necessarily going through all of it. I'm going to give you a little bit of the structure. This is basically what we'll do in the talk. We'll look first of all at the detail. What's in Leviticus chapter 1 to 7? And I'll give you a summary of what's there. And I can't really avoid the fact that I'm just going to be giving you some information. But I hope that that's valuable for you if you're reading through the book of Leviticus. Then the second thing I'm going to do in the talk is think about the invitation that lies behind these details. And to do that, we're going to spend a bit more time just studying Leviticus chapter 1, the bit that Sue read out for us, and the invitation that shapes that chapter. Okay? So let's jump into the detail. What's in Leviticus chapters 1 to 7? Why do we have these chapters? Well, the first thing that's obvious to you if you read through them all is that these are chapters about offerings or gifts, or even you might use the word presents for God. You can see it in the opening and closing verses of these chapters. The very beginning of the book of Leviticus, God calls to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. In the Hebrew there, the word, the passage even begins with a then. Then the Lord called to Moses. It's clearly flowing on from what we read at the end of the book of Exodus. And then it says, and God says to them, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any among you brings an offering to the Lord, bring as your offering an animal, either from the herd or the flock. Verse 2 there is a kind of topic sentence for the whole of these chapters. They're about offerings. And you can see that again if you go to the end. Leviticus chapter 7, the last few verses of Leviticus chapter 7. These then are the regulations for the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, the ordination offering, and the fellowship offering, which the Lord gave Moses at Mount Sinai in the desert of Sinai on the day he commanded the Israelites to bring their offerings to the Lord. And you've got a list there of the kinds of offerings that you'll find in these chapters. What is in these chapters? Well, there are five kinds of offerings: burnt offerings, grain offerings, fellowship offerings, sin offerings, and guilt offerings. In that last verse of Leviticus chapter 7, there's also an ordination offering that's mentioned, but that's a one-time thing that only Aaron does. So there are only five that kind of refer to all of the Israelites and are interesting, or not interesting, that are important for us. So over the course of seven chapters, the Israelites are given instructions on how to make these offerings or gifts or presents to God. But actually, they're given the offering, the instructions, twice. In chapters 1 to 5, the instructions are given to the people on how to do it. And then from chapter 6, verse 8 to the end of chapter 7, the same instructions, well, not the same instructions, but the instructions are repeated for the priests. So you get kind of two perspectives on the same thing. One from the people's perspective, one from the priest's perspective. Each of the offerings has a different meaning, but they add up to tell us something. The core of the sacrificial system is about enjoying the presence of God in right relationship with God. If that's the one thing that you, the kind of key idea for today, that's the one to kind of grasp, okay? The core of the sacrificial system, all of these chapters about gifts and offerings, is about enjoying God's presence in right relationship with him. Chapter 1 is about burnt offerings. And as I said, we'll come back and spend a bit of time looking at that, so I'm going to skip over it. But this kind of offering emphasizes entering into God's presence with devotion, with utter devotion. In chapter 2, you can read about grain offerings. And this is an offering that's intended to honor God. The word that's used in Hebrew to describe it gives us a sense that it's like bringing tribute, giving a gift that recognizes the worth of a person. Perhaps in our context, a similar thing might be thinking about Mother's Day next weekend, right? On Mother's Day, I hope you've kind of thought of something that you're going to give your mum, or maybe at least a phone call. I'm terrible at this kind of thing. But that gift acknowledges how special the person is to you. It's a gift that offers acknowledgement. So maybe a tribute? No. That's what the grain offering is in chapter 2. In chapter 3, we read about fellowship offerings, sometimes translated peace offerings, things like that. That's what is in chapter 3. That's the next in the order of the chapters, although when the list is given in chapter 7, it comes in a different order, and there's a reason for that. This offering is one in which people share a meal with God in his presence. And this is the one that actually blows my mind more than any of the other offerings. Some of the meat from the sacrifice is burned up, and that's a symbol of it being given to God. But actually, most of the meat from the sacrifice is left over for the person who made the sacrifice and their family and any of their guests. And they would sit around the table in the temple and they would have a barbecue. Now, in the ancient world, eating meat was something very rare, not like we get to eat it virtually every day. So this was a very special experience. To bring your family and to sit in God's home at his table and share a meal with him. And the fellowship offering, in many ways, is the climax of the offerings. It shows you what all this is about. It's about coming into God's presence, enjoying it in right relationship with Him. Those first three offerings form a group: the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fellowship offering. And they're at the heart of Israel's worship. They speak about coming into God's presence with devotion, recognizing just how wonderful He is, giving Him a gift to acknowledge that, and then enjoying His company together. As I said, this blows my mind. Because I think often I read about sacrifice in Leviticus, thinking about the sacrifice of atonement. And as we'll see in coming weeks, that's at the core of the book of Leviticus, chapter 16. But not all sacrifices are about atonement. Not all of the blood that is shed is about covering up people's guilt. In fact, the core of the sacrificial system doesn't involve that at all. It's about enjoying God's presence in right relationship with Him. None of these three sacrifices are about covering up guilt or dealing with guilt. But in order to enjoy the presence of God in right relationship with God, sin must be dealt with. And so in chapter 4, we read about the sin offering. This is an offering in which the life of an animal is offered in exchange for the life of the person who broke God's commands. And then in chapter 5, you can read about the guilt offering. And the names for these get changed as well. But it's very similar to the sin offering, except in this case, the life of the animal is offered as a restitution for a particular wrong. And you can read about the kinds of wrongs. There's sort of summary statements to let you know the kind of thing. So if you were to stand up in court and give false evidence, you would need to make a restitution for that. If you cheated your neighbour, if you found something that belonged to your next door neighbour and then kept it and didn't tell him about it, you would need to make restitution for that. You would have to offer an animal to make up for it. It pays for the penalty of the wrongdoing and helps make up for the cost of the wrongdoing. So we've got these two other offerings, gifts, a sin gift and a guilt gift, that help us to understand that in order to enjoy the presence of God in right relationship with God, sin must be dealt with first. Okay, so that's what's in Leviticus chapters 1 to 7. It's about offerings, or gifts, or presents. And there are five different types. There's burnt, a grain one, or a tribute one, a fellowship one, a sin one, and a guilt one. And there are two groups of them. The first group is the burnt offering, grain offering, fellowship offering. They're the core of life. It's about enjoying the presence of God in right relationship with Him. But there's another order to these sacrifices. So we've got the burnt grain fellowship offerings first, and then the sin and guilt offerings. When you see them actually done in practice, you can see it done in practice in Leviticus chapter 9, they're offered in a different order. The sin and guilt offerings come first. Because in order to enter the presence of God, to enjoy His presence in right relationship, sin must be dealt with. These five kinds of offerings communicate truth about who we are and the world we live in. The goal of the offerings is a meal with God, a meal of communion and fellowship in His presence. And so is your life. The goal of your life is a meal with God, fellowship and communion in His presence. That is exactly what God created the world for, to have people enjoy being with Him. And the whole of the story of the book of the Bible pictures at the end of creation, living with God in His presence forever, enjoying fellowship and communion with Him. So these sacrifices, these millions of details, are shaped by that invitation to come closer into His presence. And so is your life. All of its millions of details are shaped by that invitation, by the great story of history, which says, come closer, enjoy God's presence. Let me share a reflection that I've been thinking about as I've studied this stuff together. How do we make sense of a life that feels like a million details? There's a movement that you can read about on the internet that I sort of got a little bit obsessed with at one stage, called the quantified self. It's basically a group of people who spend all their time trying to collect as much data about themselves as they possibly can. It's kind of made famous by a man about 10 years ago who published a blog. And on it, he would record everything that he did, every minute of the day. He would keep these extraordinary Excel spreadsheets so that over the course of the year, he could tell you exactly how many minutes he'd spent waiting at red traffic lights, or how long he'd spent on the toilet, or how long it had taken him to butter his toast in the morning. And as a result of this, he could look at his whole life and he could see all of these millions of details and he could work out a story. This is what my life is about. This is where I spend my time. People who are interested in the quantified self, and honestly more and more of us are, that's people who wear Apple Watches are collecting all sorts of data about themselves, are people who are looking at millions of details and trying to work out a story. Am I getting fitter? What am I eating? How am I spending my time? What's it all mean? Sometimes I feel like my life is a million details in search of a story. Sometimes church feels like a million details in search of a story, doesn't it? If you're someone who helps to lead our church here, you often know that that's what it's like, organising rosters, helping to put together slides, helping to put the chairs out. There are lots and lots of details in the way that we spend our time together. And sometimes we need to be reminded that there's also a story. How do you make sense of a life that feels like a million details? Many of us just follow rituals that we've learned. We do the same thing over and over again, day in, day out, stroking our iPhones, getting up in the morning, going to work, watching Netflix in the evening and going to bed. What does it all add up to? The book of Leviticus reminds us that there's an invitation. So come with me and look at the invitation. We're going to do that by spending a little bit of time in Leviticus chapter 1. I want you to offer with me an offering. We're going to walk through the details and think about what would it mean to actually make this offering. A burnt offering. And as we do that, I think you'll start to see the invitation. So, once again, we've got some details. Leviticus chapter 1 begins by telling us that if you would like to make an offering, you can do it this way. If you'd like, literally, you could translate the language like this. If you would like to present a present to God in his presence, do it like this. You could choose something from the herd or from the flock. And you then get told that there are three types of offerings that you can make. There's a bull, a goat, or a bird. And it's effectively the premium, the standard, or the economy options for offerings. It really is that, right? If you've got a bull, you're making the full kind of premium version. Goat, that's just for standard. And if you really can't afford that, you can offer a bird, a young pigeon. Like any good gift shop, there's something for everyone, right? And that's what this means. Anyone can make an offering. The instructions in chapter 1 are basically the same instructions repeated three times with some variations for birds because they're smaller and a bit harder to deal with. The second thing to notice is that when you make this offering, when you present this present, you're to place your hand on the animal. And placing isn't really strong enough language. You're to press your hand onto it. And I think this is a dramatic declaration that you are this animal. You identify with it. You'll see in other contexts where the animal is making atonement for sin that by identifying with the animal, you're saying this animal dies in my place. But in a context where sin isn't involved, like this burnt offering, it's really just saying I am this animal. It represents me. And what you're therefore saying is that I offer myself to God. I'm not able to ascend God's holy mountain. I can't go through the curtain into the Holy of Holies, but this animal symbolically will. Well, what kind of animal? It's meant to be one without defect. This is a perfect bull. If you go to the Easter show, you can see these on display, just kind of piles of muscle gleaming. You know, at the Easter show, they have the kind of hair dryers, and I love watching the bulls being presented at the Easter show, because if you go around the pavilions beforehand, you can actually see them getting the bulls ready, and they'll have shampoo and hair dryers and hair colouring, making these bulls absolutely look perfect. And the perfection of the animal is meant to represent the wholeheartedness of the person who's offering it. They're not holding anything back. And who can offer it? Well, anyone can. And this should be really striking. The word in Hebrew there is Adam, Adam, which is can be the name for a bloke called Adam. But if you know the beginning of the book of Genesis, it's also the word for a human. Anyone. It can be used in a generic sense to mean men and women. If anyone wants to make an offering, present a present, male or female, Jewish people can present a present. But do you know, Gentile people can present this kind of present. You don't have to be Jewish. And in fact, you can find examples of this in the Bible. Naaman in 2 Kings. Jethro in Exodus. And Adam, any person who wants to present a present to God can do this. And then the thing to notice is the striking involvement of the person giving. This is not a passive kind of worship. It's not one of those churches where you kind of creep in and you sit down the back and you kind of watch everything happen down on the stage, and then you kind of head off home afterwards and you've got your spiritual fix. It's not going to the butcher where you kind of show up and you point to the bit of lamb chop that you want and he goes and gets it and kind of makes the cut and then presents you a nice package and off you go. You press your hand onto its head and then you read, "You slaughter the bull." And so you have to feel that knife go through its arteries in its neck and the hot blood comes spurting out. You skin the bull. That's a big job. It's going to take you a little while. You wash the excrement off its legs. This is worship, as I've heard it said, that requires an apron. And the fact that these instructions for offerings are given to the people in the first six chapters are really striking, aren't they? They are then repeated for the priests, but they're given to the people because you can make this present to God. Imagine yourself standing there in the middle of this bloody reality, the sticky, kind of warm blood everywhere, and there's a lot of blood in a bull, and the flies and the heat. There's no comfortable distance involved in this kind of worship. Giving a gift to God is a messy, bloody, involved reality. You're probably a bit more involved than you want to be. But there are some things that you can't do. And so we see the involvement of the priests. They offer the bull on the altar. There are limits on how close you can come. God is holy. You can't draw near. If you do, you will die. But if this procedure is followed correctly, then this messy, bloody reality becomes a gift, a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Notice, finally, the costliness of the gifts. We're used to industrial agriculture. So if you go driving out on the highway and you look over and you see cows, you usually see a lot of them. But you need to think much more like what you would see in Africa, a kind of nomadic and subsistence kind of farming, where people might own maybe one or two or three animals at most. What you're giving here is a substantial part of your assets. Your kids' inheritance. The dowry that would provide for your son or daughter to get married. And not only that, it's a way that you would generate wealth. You would milk the cows. You would breed the bulls. If you were to think about what an equivalent gift for us would look like, it would be something like this. If one of you wanted to give a gift to God, let him give his house. Or your car would be the standard. Or the budget gift. Maybe you could give your phone. Things that you rely on for work, that your family relies on. These are incredibly costly gifts. And that makes the next thing really striking, is that these gifts are entirely voluntary. There's not a single command in the book of Leviticus that you should do this. It's entirely up to you. If you feel like it, go for it. Be spontaneous. But if you'd like to give a gift for God, this is the kind of gift that he likes. And then the final thing to notice in this first set of gifts is that they are burnt up. The word that is translated there for kind of burnt offering in Hebrew looks a little bit like ascension offering or rising up. And that's significant. There's a whole bunch of things going on here. In this offering, all of it is burnt up. It's completely given over to God. Nothing is left over. All the other offerings, some of it is left over and used for another purpose. In this one, everything is given over to God. And so sometimes the English translations will call this the whole burnt offering, because it is wholly burnt up, given over to God. The fact that it is burnt is really important, and perhaps a little bit hard for us to visualize, but effectively what happens on this altar is that this animal is turned into smoke. And the smoke kind of rises up and kind of symbolically goes into God's presence in heaven. It's able to enter into his presence. The burning transforms the offering. It refines it, it sanctifies it, it fits it for the presence of God. And as it goes up, it becomes an ascension offering. Once you see those details, though, and you start to reflect on what it means, when you think about the costliness of the gift and its voluntariness and the fact that it's without return, all of it goes, it's almost like taking a great wad of money and just sitting down and setting fire to it. What is the point of taking such a costly animal and turning it into smoke? And you don't have to do this. It's entirely voluntary. So you should be left with the question, why? Why would anyone do it? And then another question, why would God want anyone to do it? Why would you give such a gift? Why would God want such a gift? And here, I think, are the answers. Because God wants you to come closer, to enter into his presence. But the way is shut. The invitation, come closer, leads people to make this symbolic act of coming closer. The animal represents the person, remember. As it's burnt up, it enters into God's presence. It's wholly given to him in the way that he loves his people to give themselves to him. It's costly and voluntary, extravagant, joyful worship. But because the way in is shut and you can't enter in, something else has to go in for you. And what goes in is just a symbol, just an animal. You can see this very dramatically at the start of these couple of chapters. The book of Leviticus is completely shaped by the story of the Bible that begins in Genesis. In Genesis chapter 1, God creates the world as a dwelling place, and in the seventh day it says he came to dwell in it, he rested in his creation. And then the people are pictured as living in the middle of this creation with God in the garden where he walks to and fro with them. And the description of this garden actually makes it look like an Old Testament temple. But when the people turn their backs on God, he sends them out of the garden and he closes the gate. And at the gate, he puts these cherubim, these kind of angelic beings with flaming swords that guard the way back in. What you find at the beginning of the book of Leviticus is this strange similarity and contrast with the Garden of Eden. They're in the middle of a desert now, not a garden. The scene is full of blood and burning and death and hardship. But for the first time since the Garden of Eden, God and his people are living together again. There's a space that God has made where people can come close to him. But do you know what stands at the heart of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting? Statues of cherubim, those angelic creatures with the flaming swords that say you can't come in. They stand at the curtain in the center saying you can't come in. The way back to Eden is still closed. At the end of the book of Exodus, God's glory descends on the tabernacle. He fills it with his presence again. But the glory is so bright, we read, that Moses can't enter into it. God's representative, the holiest and humblest man of the people of Israel, can't go in. In fact, the great question for the book of Leviticus is this one, and this is a bit for Bible nerds. How can the tabernacle, the word literally means dwelling, of Yahweh, it's frequently called the tabernacle, how can it become the tent of meeting, which is the other name for it? How can it be actually a place that people could go into where you could meet God? How could the dwelling of God become the tent of meeting? And in light of that question, God speaks and says, if anyone would like to bring a gift, make me a present, this is the kind of present. For the first time in history, people can live with God. In view of that incredible mercy, wouldn't you want to bring a gift? When God says, if anyone wants to bring a gift, he's answering a question that comes from the people. They say, what can I bring in view of what you've done for us? Rescuing us from slavery and death in Egypt, from a life under the shadow of death without any of your presence. What can I do to give back to the God who has given me all of these things? And God says, if any of you would like to present me a present, give me something like this. But because the gate is still closed, only the symbolic animal enters in. All of this is shaped by an invitation. Come closer. This is what is pleasing to God. Take me. Take my gifts of honor and recognition. Bring me into your presence where I can feast with you. Expensive gifts, willingly given, responding to what he has done, responding to the invitation to come closer. But in the book of Leviticus, it comes up against a door. And you can see that in the first couple of verses. It says, if any of you would like to present a present, let him present it at the entrance to the tent. You can't go in. But what if I was to say to you that the way is now open? The smoke that goes up into the presence of the Lord leaves me standing outside no longer. The invitation, come closer, has never stopped being offered. But now the time to respond is here. Not just symbolically, but really. Jesus made the atonement for us. The sacrifice that took away sin. The sacrifice that made restitution. He has carried us into the presence of God through his death once for all. The gate of Eden is not shut. And so as people who've been purified by his blood, what then shall we bring? What can I bring to you, God? If I could present you a present, what would it be? What is that present? A costly gift, voluntarily given. You, yourself, whole and entire, wholehearted, given to the Lord. Is not this exactly what Paul says in Romans chapter 12, verse 1? Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your reasonable worship. Come closer. Let me pray. Father, what will we bring to you in view of all of your mercy to us? We were exiles from you, living in darkness, without hope or meaning, without God in the world. You've opened up the door so that we might come home. What will we bring? It must be us. That's what you desire. You desire us to show us, please, how to offer ourselves as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to you. Show us how to ask that question every day of our lives. We ask this for your Son's sake. Amen. Now we're going to spend a little bit of time, as we do frequently, with some time to discuss together what we've heard. And there might, I imagine, be some questions. So if you'd like to turn with just a few people around you, I know we've gone a long time today, and if you need to head off, that's totally fine. But this is a chance, if there are things that you didn't understand, to ask the people who are sitting around you, and I'll circulate around as well. And if you'd like to ask me any questions, we'll do that. And when you feel like your kind of group's ready, you can go up and grab some morning tea. And when you need to head off, feel free to head off. This is the kind of formal end of our service. Okay.